Haynes went back out into the corridor and went from room to room through the entire building. They found other monkeys that seemed depressed, with the same glazed expression on their faces. Jax and Haynes, both of whom knew a lot about monkeys, didn't like the feel of this whole building. Something lived in here other than monkeys and people. Nancy Jax got ready to go inside. She changed into a scrub suit in the van, ran across the lawn, and entered the staging area. The support team helped her suit up. She gathered several boxes of syringes and went in with Captain Stephen Denny. They walked down the airlock corridor and came to the far door. She opened the door and found herself in the long corridor. It was empty. Everyone was down the hall in room H. Jerry thought his wife looked like the Pillsbury Doughboy. Her suit was too large for her, and it billowed around her when she walked. Nancy noticed mucus and slime on the noses of some of the monkeys. That scared her, because it seemed so much like the flu or a cold when it wasn't. Dan Dalgard, wearing a respirator and a jumpsuit, selected 4 sick monkeys for sacrifice, the ones he thought looked the sickest. He reached into the cages and gave the monkeys their shots. When they crumpled and fell asleep, he gave them a second round of shots, and that stopped their hearts. The room was jammed with people in spacesuits. They kept coming in pairs, and they milled around with nothing to do. One of them was Sergeant Curtis Clagis. He turned to someone and said, "Well, this is a big Charlie Foxtrot." That's code for CF, which means clusterfuck. This is an army operation that winds up in confusion, with people bumping into one another and demanding to know what's going on. Nancy happened to glance at the sergeant, checking his suit instinctively, and she saw that he had a tear across his hip. She touched the sergeant's arm and pointed. She reached down to her ankle, where she kept her extra tape, and taped the hole for him. She removed the 4 dead monkeys from their cages, holding them by the backs of the arms, and loaded them into plastic biohazard bags. She carried the bags to the entry door, where someone had left a garden sprayer full of Clorox bleach, along with more bags. She double-bagged the monkeys, spraying each bag with bleach, and then she loaded the bags into cardboard biohazard containers, hat boxes, and sprayed them to decon them. Finally, she loaded each hat box into a third plastic bag and sprayed it. She pounded on the door. "It's Nancy Jax. I'm coming out." The door was opened by a sergeant standing on the other side, a member of the decon team. He was wearing a Raycal suit, and he had a pump sprayer filled with bleach. She went into the airlock, pushing the hat boxes ahead of her. In the darkness and in the whine of their blowers, he shouted to her, "Stand with your arms out and turn around slowly." He sprayed her for 5 minutes, until the airlock stank of bleach. It felt wonderfully cool, but the smell leaked through her filters and made her throat sting. He also sprayed the bags. Then he opened the door to the staging area, and she blinked at the light and came out, pushing the bags ahead of her. The support team peeled off her suit. She was drenched with sweat. Her scrubs were soaked. Now it was freezing cold. She ran across the lawn and changed into her civilian clothes in the back of the van. Meanwhile, people loaded the bags into boxes and loaded the boxes into the refrigerator truck, and Nancy and a driver headed off for Fort Detrick. She wanted to get those monkeys into level 4 and opened up as fast as possible. Jerry Jax counted 65 animals in the room after the 4 that Nancy had removed. Gene Johnson had brought a special injector back from Africa. Jerry used this device to give shots to the monkeys. It was a pole that had a socket on one end. You fitted a syringe into the socket, and you slid the pole into the cage and gave the monkey a shot. You also needed a tool to pin the monkey down, because monkeys don't like needles coming at them. They used a mop handle with a soft U-shaped pad on the end. Captain Haynes held the mop handle against the monkey to immobilize it, and Jerry ran the pole into the cage and hit the monkey's thigh with a double dose of ketamine, a general anesthetic. They went through the room from cage to cage, hitting all the monkeys with the drug. Pretty soon the monkeys began to collapse in their cages. Once a monkey was down, Jerry gave it a shot of a sedative called Rompin, which put it into a deep sleep. When all the monkeys were down and asleep, they set up a couple of stainless steel tables, and then, one monkey at a time, they took blood samples from the unconscious monkeys and gave them a third injection, this time of a lethal drug called T-61, which is a euthanasia agent. After a monkey was clinically dead, it was opened up by Captain Steve Denny. He took samples of liver and spleen, using scissors, and he dropped the samples into plastic bottles. They bagged the dead monkeys, loaded them into hat boxes, and piled the hat boxes along the corridor. Dan Dalgard, meanwhile, left the room and remained in an office at the front of the building for the rest of the day. By late afternoon, all the monkeys in Room H had been put to death. Behind the building, through the trees and down the hill, children ran in circles around their playhouse. Their shouts carried far in the December air. Their mothers and fathers arrived in cars and picked them up. The team exited from the hot zone in pairs and stood around on the grass in their civilian clothes, looking pale, weak, and thoughtful. In the distance, floodlights began to light up the monuments and buildings of Washington. It was the Friday evening, at the end of the week following Thanksgiving, the start of a quiet weekend that precedes the Christmas season. The wind strengthened and blew paper cups and empty cigarette packs in eddies around the parking lots. In a hospital not far from there, Jarvis Purdy, the monkey worker who had had a heart attack, rested comfortably, his condition stable. Back at the Institute, Nancy Jacks again stayed up until 1 o'clock in the morning, dissecting monkeys with her hot zone buddy, Ron Trotter. When they had suited up and gone in, there had been 5 monkey carcasses waiting for them in the airlock. This time, the signs of Ebola were obvious. Nancy saw what she described as horrendous gut lesions in some of the animals, caused by sloughing of the intestinal lining. That sloughing of the gut was a classic sign. The intestine was blitzed, completely full of uncoagulated, runny blood, and at the same time, the monkey had had massive blood clotting in the intestinal muscles. The clotting had shut off blood circulation to the gut, and the cells in the gut subsequently died, that is, the intestines had died, and then the gut had filled up with blood. Dead intestine, this was the kind of thing you saw in a decayed carcass. In her words, it looked like the animals had been dead for 3 or 4 days. Yet they had been dead only for hours. Some of the monkeys were so badly liquefied that she and Trotter didn't even bother to do a necropsy. They just yanked samples of liver and spleen from the dead animal. Some of the monkeys that were dying in Room H had become essentially a heap of mush and bones in a skin bag, mixed with huge amounts of amplified virus. December 4th, 0730 hours, Monday. Monday arrived cold and raw, with a rising wind that brought a smell of snow from a sky the color of plain carbon steel. In the shopping malls around Washington, Christmas lights had been hung. The parking lots were empty, but later in the day they would fill up with cars, and the malls would fill up with parents and children, and the children would line up to see Santa Clauses. Dan Dalgard drove to the Primate building, one more commuter in a sea of morning traffic. He turned into the parking lot. As he got closer to the building, he saw that a man was standing by the front door near the sweet gum tree, wearing a white Tyvek jumpsuit. It was one of the monkey caretakers. Dalgard was furious. He'd instructed them not to come out of the building wearing a mask or a protective suit. He jumped out of his car, slammed the door, and hurried across the parking lot. As he got closer, he recognized the man as someone who will be called Milton Frantig. Frantig was standing bent over with his hands on his knees. He didn't seem to notice Dalgard. He was staring at the grass. Suddenly, Frantig's body convulsed, and liquid spewed out of his mouth. He vomited again and again, and the sound of his retching carried across the parking lot. A man down. As Dan Dalgard watched the man spill his stomach out onto the lawn, he felt, in his words, scared shitless. Now, perhaps for the first time, the absolute horror of the crisis at the primate building washed over him. Milton Frantig was doubled over, gasping and choking. When his vomiting subsided, Dalgard helped him to his feet, took him indoors, and made him lie down on a couch. Two employees were now sick. Jarvis Purdy was still in the hospital, recovering from a heart attack. Milton Frantig was 50 years old. He had a chronic hacking cough, although he didn't smoke. He'd been working with monkeys and with Dalgard at Hazelton for more than 25 years. Dalgard knew the man well and liked him. Dalgard felt shaken, sick with fear and guilt. Maybe I should have evacuated the building last week. Did I put the interests of the monkeys ahead of the interests of the human beings? Milton Frantig was pale and shaky and felt faint. He developed the dry heaves. Dalgard found a plastic bucket for him. Between heaves, interrupted by coughing spells, Frantig apologized for leaving the building while wearing a jumpsuit. He said he had just been putting on his respirator to go inside a monkey room when he began to feel sick to his stomach. Perhaps the bad smell in the building had nauseated him, because the monkey rooms weren't being cleaned as regularly as usual. He could feel he was about to vomit, and he couldn't find a bucket or anything to throw up into, and it was coming on so fast that he couldn't get to the restroom, so he had run outdoors. Dalgard wanted to take Frantig's temperature, but nobody could find a thermometer that hadn't been used rectally on monkeys. He sent Bill Volt to a drugstore to buy one. When he returned, they discovered that Frantig had a fever of 101. Bill Volt hovered in the room, almost shaking with fear. Volt wasn't doing well, almost spastic in his terror, Dalgard would later recall. But it wasn't any different from the way Dalgard felt. Milton Frantig remained the calmest person in the room. Unlike Dalgard and Volt, he didn't seem afraid. He was a devout Christian, comfortable with telling people that he'd been saved. If the Lord saw fit to take him home with a monkey disease, he was ready. He prayed a little, remembering his favorite passages in the Bible, and his dry heaves subsided. Soon he was resting quietly on the couch and said he felt a little better. "I want you to stay where you are," Dalgard said to him. "Don't leave the building." He got into his car and drove as fast as he could to the Hazelton, Washington offices on Leesburg Pike. The drive didn't take long, and by the time he got there, he'd made up his mind. The monkey facility had to be evacuated immediately. There'd been four workers employed in the building, and two of them were now going to be in the hospital. One man had heart problems, and now the other had a fever with vomiting. From what Dalgard knew about Ebola virus, either of these illnesses could be signs of infection. They had shopped at malls and visited friends and eaten in restaurants. Dalgard thought they were probably having sexual intercourse with their wives. He didn't even want to think about the consequences. When he arrived at Hazelton, Washington, he went directly to the office of the general manager. He intended to brief him about the situation and get his approval to evacuate the monkey house. "We've got two guys who are sick," Dalgard said to him. He began to describe what had happened, and he started crying. He couldn't control it. He broke down and wept. Trying to pull himself together, he said, "I recommend that the entire operation be shut down as soon as possible. My recommendation is we close it down and turn it over to the army. We've had this goddamn disease since October, and we haven't gotten injured, and all of a sudden, we've got two guys sick, one in the hospital, one who's going there. I kept on thinking that if there was a real human risk, we would have seen something by now. We've played with fire for too long. The general manager sympathized with Dalgard and agreed with him that the monkey facility ought to be evacuated and shut down. Then, holding back his tears, Dalgard hurried to his own office, where he found a group of officials from the CDC waiting for him. He felt as if the pressure would never let up. The CDC people had arrived at Hazleton to begin surveillance of all employees who had been exposed to the virus. Dalgard told them what had just happened at the monkey house, that a man had gone down with vomiting. He said, "I've recommended that the facility be evacuated. I feel that the building and the monkeys should be turned over to the people from USAMRID, who have the equipment and personnel to handle it safely." The CDC people listened and didn't disagree. Then there was the question of what to do with Milton Frantic, who was still lying on the couch under orders from Dalgard not to move. Since the CDC was in charge of the human aspects of the outbreak, the CDC was in charge of Frantic, and the CDC wanted him taken to Fairfax Hospital inside the Washington Beltway. It was now 9:20 in the morning. Dalgard sat in his office and sweated it out, managing the crisis by telephone. He called C.J. Peters at Fort Detrick and told him that he had a monkey caretaker who was sick. In his dry, calm voice, now without any hint that he had recently been weeping, he said to Peters, "You have permission to consider the facility and all the animals to be the responsibility of USAMRID." Colonel C.J. Peters was a little distrustful of the phrase, "the responsibility of USAMRID." It implied that if anything went wrong and people died, the Army could be held responsible and could be sued. He wanted to take control of the building and nuke it, but he didn't want lawsuits. So he said to Dalgard that the safety of his people and the safety of the general public were the most important things to him, but that he would have to clear this with his command. He said he would get back to Dalgard as soon as possible. Then they talked about the sick man, and CJ learned that he was being taken to Fairfax Hospital. That disturbed him greatly. He felt that it should be assumed that the guy was breaking with Ebola. And do you really want to bring a guy like that into a community hospital? Look at what Ebola had done in hospitals in Africa. CJ thought the man belonged in the slammer at the Institute. As soon as he got off the line with Dalgard, C.J. Peters telephoned Joe McCormick, who was in charge of the CDC effort. He said to McCormick something like, "I know you have this idea that a surgical mask and gown are all you need to handle an Ebola patient, but I think you need to use a higher level of containment." And he offered to pick up the sick man in an Army ambulance, put him in an Army biocontainment pod, and carry the pod to the Army's facilities at the Institute. Put him in the slammer. C.J. Peters recalls that McCormick said to him something like, "I want the guy at Fairfax Hospital." C.J. replied, "All right, I believe this, Joe, and you believe that, and we don't agree. Regardless, what's going to happen to the medical personnel at Fairfax Hospital or to you, Joe, if Ebola virus gets into that hospital?" McCormick wouldn't budge on his decision. He'd been face-to-face with Ebola in Africa, and he hadn't gotten sick. He'd worked for days inside a mud hut that was smeared with Ebola blood, on his knees among people who were crashing and bleeding out. You didn't need a spacesuit to handle an Ebola patient. They could be handled by skilled nurses in a good hospital. The guy was going to Fairfax Hospital. C.J. Peters, in spite of his strong dislike for McCormick, found himself admiring him for making strong decisions in a very difficult situation. A television news van arrived at the monkey house from Channel 4 in Washington. The workers peered through curtains at the van. And when the reporter came to the door and pushed the buzzer, no one answered. Dalgard had made it clear to them that no one was to talk to the media. Just then, an ambulance from Fairfax Hospital arrived to take Frantic away. Channel 4's timing couldn't have been better. The news team turned on their lights and started filming the action. The door of the monkey house swung open, and Milton Frantic stumbled out, still wearing his Tyvek suit, looking embarrassed. He walked over to the ambulance. The medical team opened the back doors of the vehicle, and Frantic climbed in by himself and lay down on the gurney. They slammed the doors and took off, with Channel 4 following them. A few minutes later, the ambulance and Channel 4 pulled into Fairfax Hospital. Frantic was put in an isolation room, with access restricted to doctors and nurses wearing rubber gloves, gowns, and surgical masks. He said he felt better. He prayed to the Lord and watched a little television. Back at the monkey house, the situation had become unbearable for the remaining workers. They'd seen people in spacesuits. They'd seen their colleague puking in the grass. They'd seen Channel 4 chasing the ambulance. They left the building in a real hurry, locking it after themselves. There were 450 monkeys alive in the building, and their hoots and cries sounded in the empty hallways. It was 11 o'clock in the morning. A snow flurry came and went. The weather was turning colder. In the monkey house, the air handling equipment had failed for good. The air temperature in the building had soared beyond 90 degrees, and the place had turned steamy, odorous, alive with monkey calls. The animals were hungry now, because they hadn't been fed their morning biscuits. Here and there, in rooms all over the building, some of the animals stared from glazed eyes in mask-like faces, and some of them had blood running from their orifices. It landed on metal trays under their cages. Ping, ping, ping. '91 Tangos. 10:30 hours, Monday. The crisis was getting worse at Reston. Dan Dalgard felt he was losing control of everything. He set up a conference call with all the senior managers in his company and informed them of the situation. Two employees were down, and the second man could be breaking with Ebola. And he told the managers that he'd offered to turn the monkey house over to the Army. They approved his action, but they said they wanted the oral agreement with the Army to be put in writing. Furthermore, they wanted the Army to agree to take legal responsibility for the building. Dalgard then called C.J. Peters and asked that the Army assume responsibility for any liability that would arise after the Army took over. C.J. flatly rejected that proposal. He saw a need for clarity, speed, and no lawyers. He felt that the outbreak had ballooned to the point where a decision had to be made. Dalgard agreed to fax him a simple letter, turning the monkey house over to the Army. They worked up some language, and C.J. carried the letter by hand to the office of General Philip Russell. He and the general pored over the letter, but they didn't choose to show it to any Army lawyers. Russell said, "We have to convince the lawyers of the path of righteousness." They signed the letter, faxed it back to Dalgard, and the monkey house fell into the hands of the Army. Jerry Jacks would have to lead a much larger biohazard team back into the monkey house. The number of animals that needed to be dealt with was staggering. His troops were untested, and he himself had never been in combat. He didn't know, couldn't know, how he or his people would perform in a chaotic situation involving intense fear of an unpleasant death. Jerry was the commanding officer of the 91 Tangos at the Institute. The Army's animal care technicians are classified 91T, which in Army jargon becomes 91 Tango. The younger 91 Tangos are 18 years old and are privates. While the ambulance was taking Milton Frantic to the hospital, Jerry called a meeting of his 91 Tangos and civilian staff in a conference room in the Institute. Although most of the soldiers were young and had very little or no experience in spacesuits, the civilians were older men, and some were level 4 specialists who had worn chemchurians on a daily basis. The room was jammed and people sat on the floor. "The virus is Ebola, or an Ebola-like agent," he said to them. "We're going to be handling large amounts of blood, and we will be handling sharp instruments. We're going to use the disposable biocontainment suits." The room was silent while he spoke. He didn't mention that a man was down because he didn't know about it. C.J. Peters hadn't told him about that. For the time being, Peters was staying quiet about that development. Jerry said to his people, "We're looking for volunteers. Is there anyone in this room who does not want to go? We can't make you go." When no one backed out, Jerry looked around the room and picked his people. "Yep, he's going, she's going, and yep, you're going." In the crowd, there was a sergeant named Swiderski, and Jerry decided that she couldn't go because she was pregnant. Ebola has particularly nasty effects on pregnant women. No combat unit in the army could handle this work. There would be no hazard pay, as there is in a war zone. The army has a theory regarding biological spacesuits. The theory is that work inside a spacesuit is not hazardous because you're wearing a spacesuit. Hell, if you handled hot agents without a spacesuit, that would be hazardous work. The privates would get their usual pay, $7 an hour. Jerry told them that they were not to discuss the operation with anyone, not even members of their families. "If you have any tendency to claustrophobia, consider it now," he said. He told them to wear civilian clothes and to show up at the Institute's loading dock at 0500 hours the next morning. December 4th and 5th, Monday to Tuesday. The soldiers didn't sleep much that night, and neither did Gene Johnson. He was terrified for the kids, as he called them. He'd had his fair share of scares with hot agents. Once, in Zaire, he had stuck himself with a bloody needle while taking blood from a mouse. There was reason to believe the mouse was hot, and so they had airlifted him to the Institute and put him in the slammer for 30 days. "That wasn't a fun trip," as he put it. "They treated me as if I'd die. They wouldn't give me scissors to cut my beard because they thought I would be suicidal. And they locked me in at night." At Katoom Cave, while wearing a spacesuit and dissecting animals, he'd been nicked 3 times with bloody tools. 3 times his spacesuit had been punctured and his skin broken and the cuts smeared with animal blood. He regarded himself as lucky not to have picked up Marburg or something else at Katoom Cave. Having had some close calls, he was deeply afraid of what had invaded the monkey house. Johnson lived in a rambling house on the side of Catoctin Mountain. He sat in his study most of the night, thinking about procedures. Every movement of the body in a hot area has to be controlled and planned. He said to himself, "Where's this virus going to get you? It's going to get you through the hands. The hands are the weak point. Above all, the hands must be under control." He sat in an easy chair and held up one hand and studied it. 4 fingers and an opposed thumb. Exactly like a monkey's hand, except that it was wired to a human mind. And it could be enclosed and shielded by technology. The thing that separated the human hand from nature was the spacesuit. He stood up and went through motions in the air with his hands. Now he was giving a monkey an injection. Now he was carrying the monkey to a table. He was putting the monkey on the table. He was in a hot zone. He was opening the monkey up, and now he was putting his hands into a bloody lake of amplified hot agent. His hands were covered with 3 layers of rubber, and then smeared with blood and hot agent. He paused and jotted notes on paper. Then he turned back to his imaginary hot zone. He inserted a pair of scissors into the monkey and clipped out part of the spleen. He handed it to someone. Where would that person be standing? Behind him? Now he imagined himself holding a needle in his hand. "Okay, I have a needle in my hand. It's a lethal object. I'm holding it in my right hand if I'm right-handed. Therefore, my buddy should stand to my left, away from the needle. Now my buddy's hands. What will my buddy's hands be doing? What will everyone's hands be doing? By early in the morning, he'd written many pages of notes. It was a script for a biohazard operation. Jerry Jacks left home at 4 o'clock in the morning while Nancy was still asleep. He met Gene Johnson at the loading dock, where they went over Gene's script. Jerry memorized it, and meanwhile the team members began to show up, soldiers in Jerry's unit. Many of them arrived on foot, having walked over from their barracks. They stood around waiting for their orders. It was pitch dark, and only the floodlights illuminated the scene. Jerry decided to use a buddy system inside the building, and he began deciding who would be paired with whom. On a piece of paper, he drew up a roster of buddies, and he wrote down the order of entry, the sequence in which they would be inserted into the building. He stood before them and read the roster, and they got into their vehicles. A white refrigerator truck, a couple of unmarked passenger vans, an unmarked pickup truck, the white ambulance containing the bubble stretcher, and a number of civilian cars, and headed for Reston. They became trapped in rush hour traffic again, surrounded by half-asleep yuppies in suits who were sucking coffee from foam cups and listening to traffic reports and easy rock and roll. When all the vehicles had arrived at the back of the monkey house, the teams assembled on the lawn, and Gene Johnson asked for their attention. His eyes were sunken and dark, suggesting he hadn't slept in days. "We are not playing games here," he said. "This is the real thing. A biological level 4 outbreak is not a training session. There's been a development I want you all to know about. There's a possibility that transmission of this virus to humans has taken place. There are 2 people who are ill and are hospitalized. Both of them are animal caretakers who worked in this building. There's one guy we're especially worried about. Yesterday morning he became sick. He vomited and spiked a fever. He's now in the hospital. We don't know if he's breaking with Ebola. The thing I want you to understand is that he wasn't bitten by an animal and he didn't cut himself or stick himself with a needle. So if he has Ebola, there's a possibility he got it through airborne transmission." Jerry Jacks listened to the speech with a rising sense of horror. He hadn't known about this man getting sick. Nobody had told him about this. Now he had a feeling that there were going to be casualties. It was an icy gray day. The trees behind the monkey house had lost their leaves, and dead leaves rustled across the lawn. At the daycare center down the hill, parents had been dropping off their children, and the children were playing on swings. Gene Johnson continued his speech. "Everyone is to proceed on the assumption that Ebola virus is potentially airborne," he said. "You know the risks, and you're experienced." And his eyes rested on a private first class named Nicole Burke. She was quite beautiful. Long blonde hair, 18 years old, and he thought, "Who's she? I've never seen her before. Must be one of Jerry's people. They're just kids. They don't know what they're up against." "You must follow the procedures exactly," he went on. "If you have any questions, you must ask." Jerry got up and said to them, "No question is too stupid. If you have a question, ask." Private Nicole Burke was wondering if she would get a chance to go into the building. "How long are we going to be doing this, sir?" she asked him. "Until the monkeys are dead," he replied. "There are 450 monkeys in there." Oh, God, she thought. 450 monkeys. This is going to take forever. The questions were few. People were tense, silent, turned inward. Jerry Jacks entered the staging room and a support team helped him put on his Raykel suit. They fitted the bubble over his head, and his blowers started to roar. He told the teams he'd see them inside, and he and his buddy, Sergeant Thomas Amon, entered the airlock. The door closed behind them, and they stood in darkness. They felt their way down the dark airlock corridor, opened the far door, and crossed over to the hot side. The area was trashed. It hadn't been cleaned in many days. The workers had left in a big hurry. There were monkey biscuits scattered all over the floor, and papers were scattered everywhere, and there were overturned chairs in the offices. It looked as if the humans had fled from here. Jerry and the sergeant began exploring the building. They moved slowly and carefully in their suits, as if they were wreck divers operating in deep water. Jerry found himself in a small corridor that opened into more monkey rooms. He saw a room full of monkeys, and every one of the animals was looking out at him. 70 pairs of monkey eyes fixed on a pair of human eyes in a spacesuit. And the animals went nuts. They were hungry and were hoping to be fed. They'd trash their room. Even locked inside cages, monkeys could really do a job on a room. They'd been throwing their biscuits all over the place, and they'd been finger-painting the walls with dung. The walls were scribbled all the way up to the ceiling with monkey writing. It was a cryptic message to the human race that came out of the primate soul. Jerry and the sergeant found some bags of monkey biscuits and went into each room in the building and fed the monkeys. The animals were going to die soon, but Jerry didn't want them to suffer more than they had to. While he fed them, he inspected them for signs of Ebola. In many of the rooms, he found animals that seemed dull-eyed and listless. Some of them had runny noses, or there was a kind of blood-spattered green crust caked around the nostrils. He saw puddles of blood in some of the pans under their cages. These sights disturbed him deeply, because they told him that the agent had gone all through the building. He could see some of the animals coughing and sneezing, as if they had the flu. He wondered if he was seeing a mutant form of Ebola, a kind of airborne Ebola flu. He shrank from the idea and tried to turn his mind away from it, for it was too awful to contemplate. You could no more imagine it than you could imagine a nuclear war. A layer of sweat built up inside his plastic head bubble, making it difficult for him to see the monkeys clearly. But he could hear them, shrieking and calling distantly beyond the sound of his blowers. So far, he hadn't felt any claustrophobia or panic. He wasn't going to lose it in here. Several members of the team spent the next half hour in the staging room. They were shucking syringes, removing them from a sterile envelope, and fitting each syringe with a needle. Now the syringes were ready to be filled with drugs. A few feet from the soldiers, Captain Mark Haynes began to suit up. While the support team got him dressed, he gave a speech. He wanted the soldiers to keep certain things in mind as they followed him in. He said, "You're going to euthanize a whole building full of animals. This isn't a fun operation. Don't get attached to the animals. They were going to die anyway. They're all going to have to go, every last one of them. Don't think of it as killing something. Think of it as stopping the virus here without letting it get anywhere else. Don't play with the monkeys. I don't want to hear laughing and joking around the animals. I can be hard. Remember the veterinarian's creed. You have a responsibility to animals, and you have a responsibility to science. These animals gave their lives to science. They were caught up in this thing, and it's not their fault. They had nothing to do with it. Keep an eye on your buddy. Never hand a used needle to another person. If a needle comes out of its cap, it goes straight into an animal. Put the used syringe into a sharps container. If you get tired, tell your supervisor, and we'll decon you out." He turned away from them and went in with his buddy. "Who's next?" Gene Johnson said, reading the roster. "Godwin, you're next." A private first class named Charlotte Godwin hurried outdoors to the van and climbed inside, and took off all her clothes and put on a surgical scrub suit, socks, sneakers, and a hair cap. It was brutally cold in the van. She felt embarrassed and vulnerable. In the staging room, they began to suit her up. Someone said to her, "You're kind of small. We've got a special suit for you." It wasn't special. It was a large suit, sized for a big man, and she was 5 feet tall. It hung around her like a bag. The support team was taping her now, running brown sticky tape around her ankles and wrists, and her blowers came on. An army photographer took some photographs for the action file, and as the flash went off, she thought, "God, I would be wearing a hair cap. It's a clown cap. It's a bozo hat. You won't see my hair in the picture, and my spacesuit is too large for me. Makes me look fat. Just my luck to be the one looking like a dork in the action photographs." She staggered into the gray zone, carrying boxes of supplies, and felt a sweeping adrenal rush and thought, "I'm too young to be going through this." She was 18. Then she noticed the smell. A really bad smell was creeping through her filters. Her buddy pounded on the far door and they entered. Ripples in the faceplate of her head bubble distorted the view, as if she was in a house of mirrors. The smell of monkey was overpowering inside her spacesuit. It was also too quiet, and monkey houses are not quiet places. The quiet bothered her even more than the smell or the heat. A door swung open, and Colonel Jax appeared. He said, "Start loading syringes. Double doses of ketamine." "Yes, sir," she replied. "The sergeant and I will be knocking down monkeys in here," he said. Charlotte started filling syringes with ketamine, the anesthetic. Jerry Jax carried a loaded syringe into the monkey room and fitted it to the socket of a pole syringe. The sergeant fished his mop handle into a cage and pinned a monkey. Then Jerry opened the door of the cage. Watching the monkey carefully to make sure it didn't try to rush at him, he slid the pole syringe through the open door and gave the monkey an injection of anesthetic, and then pulled out the syringe and slammed the door shut. It was the most dangerous job because of the open door. The animal could attack or try to escape. Jerry and the sergeant went from cage to cage, and the monkeys began to go to sleep under the anesthesia. The rooms contained double banks of monkey cages. The lower bank was near the floor and was dark. Jerry had to get down on his knees to peer inside. He could hardly see anything through his head bubble. His knees were killing him. He would open a cage door, and the sergeant would slide the mop handle into the cage. The monkey would scrabble around, trying to escape, and the sergeant would say, "Okay, I got him. He's pinned." Jerry would slide the pull syringe toward the monkey, aiming the needle for the thigh. There would be screeches and a wild commotion, the monkey shrieking, "Craw, craw," and the needle would sink in. This was turning out to be one of the hardest things he'd ever done in his career as a veterinarian. More team members came into the building. Jerry assembled them in the hallway and said to them, "Stop every 5 or 10 minutes and check your neighbor's suit for rips. Be very careful. Make sure you take rest breaks. I want you to rest for 10 minutes every hour. When you get tired, you get careless." Every time he looked into a monkey room, he saw a room full of eyes looking back at him. Some of the monkeys rattled their cages, and the wave of noise swept up and down the room. Jerry decided to set up a bleed area in a small room near the front of the building, right next to the offices. In the bleed area, there was a shower with a drain hole in the floor. They would need to use the drain hole for washing down blood and for rinsing down objects with bleach. Every time blood went down the drain, they would pour bleach after it. They didn't want this thing getting into the Reston sewage system. They found a metal examination table on wheels and rolled it into the bleed area. Jerry divided the people into sub-teams. A bleed team, to work at the bleed table. A euthanasia team, to put the monkeys to death. And a necropsy team, to open up the monkeys and take samples and bag the carcasses in biohazard bags. They got an assembly line going. Every 5 minutes or so, Jerry Jacks would carry an unconscious monkey out of a room and down the corridors to the bleed area, holding the animal with its arms pinned behind its back. He would lay it down on the bleed table, and then Captain Haynes, the Green Beret, would insert a needle into the animal's thigh and draw off a lot of blood into various tubes. Then he'd hand the unconscious animal to Major Nate Powell, and he would give it an injection of T-61, the euthanasia agent. He'd put the needle right into the heart. When the animal was clearly dead, he would hand it to Captain Steve Denny, who did the necropsy. Captain Denny opened the animal with scissors and snipped out parts of the liver and spleen. The livers of these animals were gray, eroded, nasty-looking. Private Charlotte Godwin stood beside Captain Denny and handed him tools. She thought he looked nervous, jumpy, inside his spacesuit. He pulled a spleen out of a monkey. It was speckled with white spots as hard as a rock, a biological bomb ticking with hot agent. After a while, he handed the scissors to her and gave her a chance to open up a monkey. It frightened her and gave her a big rush. She was doing a hot necropsy in level 4, perhaps the most dangerous work in a spacesuit. This was a rocket ride, and it thrilled her. Her hands worked within a membrane's thickness of a death worse than any death in combat. She found herself racing to finish the job. She noticed that the monkey's eyes were open. It was as if the monkey was looking at her while she worked. She wanted to reach out and close the monkey's eyes. She thought, "Is my face the last thing they see?" Inside. Early evening. Tuesday. The day wore on, and people began using up their batteries. They could see that the daylight was starting to go because some windows at the ends of the hallways were getting dark. Jerry Jacks made people rest every now and then. They sat on the floor with blank looks on their faces, exhausted. Or they loaded syringes with drugs. Meanwhile, Jerry went from person to person trying to gauge the level of exhaustion. "How are you doing? Are you tired? Do you want to go out?" Nobody wanted to go out. The team inside the building maintained radio contact with Gene Johnson outside the building. He'd supplied them with handheld, shortwave radios that operated on a military band. He hadn't given them ordinary walkie-talkies because he didn't want anybody listening to the talk, especially the news media, who might make a tape recording of the chatter. It seemed less likely that anyone would listen to these radios. Something went wrong with one of the soldiers' suits. She was a specialist named Rhonda Williams. Her blower cut off, and her suit began to go limp until it stuck to her sweaty scrub suit, and she felt contaminated air creeping around her. "My air's going off," she shouted. She kept working. She couldn't leave her post. Her battery was failing. She discovered that she didn't have a spare battery on her belt. All the others had used their spare batteries. When Rhonda announced that her air was shutting down, it caused a commotion. Jerry wanted to evacuate her from the building. He ran down the hall to the airlock door, where a soldier was stationed with a shortwave radio. Jerry grabbed the radio and called Gene Johnson, shouting through his helmet, "We've got a lady who's losing her battery." Gene answered, "We need to get a battery and send it in with someone. Can you wait?" "No, she's coming out. She's losing her air," Jerry said. Abruptly, the soldier by the door told Jerry that he had an extra battery. Jerry said over the radio, "Wait! We have an extra one." The soldier ran down the hallway to Rhonda, grinned at her, and said, "Your battery is here." People started laughing. He clipped it to Rhonda's belt. She thought, "Oh my God, they're going to unlock my old battery. It's going to stop my blowers." She said, "Wait a minute. My air's going to go off." "Don't worry. It's just for a second while we switch you over," he said. Rhonda was rattled and was ready to leave. She was wondering if she'd caught the virus during the moments when her air pressure had been lost. Jerry decided to send her out with Charlotte Godwin, who seemed to be getting tired. On the radio, he said to Jean, "I have two coming out." On Jean's side, a near panic was occurring. A television van had just showed up. Jean was appalled. He didn't want the cameras to start rolling just as two women in spacesuits were extracted from the building. He said to Jerry, "We're jammed. We can't move them out. We've got TV cameras out here." "I'm sending them out," Jerry said. "All right, send them out," Jean said. "We'll give the cameras a show." Jerry pounded on the door of the gray area, and the decon man opened it. He was a sergeant. He wore a spacesuit. He held a pump sprayer filled with bleach and a flashlight. Rhonda and Charlotte walked into the gray area, and the sergeant told them to hold their arms straight out at their sides. He played the flashlight over their spacesuits, checking for damage or leaks. Rhonda noticed that he had a strange look on his face. "You have a hole in your suit," he said. "I knew this was going to happen," she thought. "Where did you get it?" he asked. "I don't know." He slapped a piece of tape over the hole. Then he washed the two soldiers down with bleach, spraying it all over them, and pounded on the door that led to the staging room. Someone opened it, and they went out. Immediately, the support team opened their head bubbles and peeled off their suits. Their scrub suits underneath were soaked with sweat. They began to shiver. "There's a television news van out front," Jean said. "I had a hole in my suit," Rhonda said to him. "Did I get the virus?" "No. You had enough pressure in your suit to protect you the whole time." He hurried them outdoors. "Get into the van and lie down," he said. "If anybody asks you any questions, keep your mouth shut." They couldn't find their clothes in the van. They rolled themselves up in some overcoats to keep warm and lay down on the seats, out of sight. The television crew parked their van near the front door of the monkey house, and the reporter began to poke around, followed by a cameraman. The reporter knocked on the front door and rang the buzzer. No answer. He peered in the front windows. The curtains were drawn, and he couldn't see anything. Well, nothing was happening in there. This place was deserted. He and the cameraman didn't notice the white vehicles parked behind the building, or if they noticed them, it didn't seem interesting. There was nothing going on here. The television men returned to their van and sat in it for a while, hoping that something would happen or that someone would show up so that they could get some sound bites for the evening news. But this was getting to be boring. It was an awfully cold day, and the light was fading. It didn't occur to them to go around to the side of the building and point their video camera toward a window. If they had done that, they would have gotten enough footage to fill the entire evening news, with something left over for CBS's 60 Minutes. They would have gotten footage of soldiers in spacesuits smeared with Ebola blood, engaged in the first major biohazard mission the world ever knew. And they would have gotten shots of biohazard buddies coming out into the staging area in pairs and being stripped of their suits by the support teams. But the news crew didn't walk around the building, and so far as I know, there is no video footage of the rest in action. Meanwhile, the two women lay on their backs in the van for many minutes. Suddenly, the television crew left. Jean Johnson, poking his head around the corner of the building, reported that the coast was clear. The women got dressed and then hurried off to relieve themselves in the wooded area behind the building. That was where they found the needles. 2 used hypodermic syringes with needles attached to them. The needles were uncapped and bare, obviously used. It was impossible to tell how long they had been lying in the grass. Some of the safety people put on gloves and picked up the needles, and as they searched the area, they found more needles in the grass. The last person to come out was Jerry Jacks. He emerged around 6 in the evening, having lost between 5 and 10 pounds of weight. It was fluid loss from sweating, and his face was ashen. His hair, instead of looking silver, looked white. There was no food for the soldiers, and they were hungry and thirsty. The soldiers took a vote on where to eat, and it came out in favor of Taco Bell. Gene Johnson said to them, "Don't tell anybody why you're here. Don't answer any questions." The caravan started up, engines roaring in the cold, and headed for Taco Bell. The soldiers ordered soft tacos with many, many jumbo Cokes to replace the sweat they'd lost inside their spacesuits. They also ordered a vast number of cinnamon twists. Everything to go. Yeah, put it in boxes and hurry, please. The employees were staring at them. The soldiers looked like soldiers, even in jeans and sweatshirts. The men were bulked up and hard-looking, with crew cuts and metal-framed military eyeglasses, and a few zits from too much army food, and the women looked as if they could do 50 push-ups and break down a weapon. A man came up to Sergeant Clagus while he was waiting for his food and said, "What were you doing over there? I saw all those vans." Sergeant Clagus turned his back on the man without saying a word. After midnight, on the waterbed in the master bedroom of the Jacks house on the slopes of Catoctin Mountain, Nancy and Jerry Jacks caught up on the news while their daughter Jamie slept beside them. Jerry told her that the day's operation had gone reasonably well and that no one had stuck himself or herself with a needle. He told her he hadn't realized how lonely it is inside a biohazard suit. Nancy wrapped herself around him and rested her head against his neck, in the way they'd held each other since college. She thought he looked shrunken and thin. He was physically more exhausted than she'd seen him in years. She picked up Jamie and carried her to bed, and then returned and folded herself around her husband. They fell asleep holding each other. A bad day. December 6th, Wednesday. For the past several days and nights, an Army scientist named Thomas Kaizek had been working in his spacesuit in a Level 4 lab, trying to develop a rapid test for Ebola virus in blood and tissue. He got the test to work. It was called a rapid ELISA test, and it was sensitive and easy to perform. He tested urine and blood samples from Milton Frantig, the man who had vomited on the lawn and who was now in an isolation room at Fairfax Hospital. Frantig came up clean. His urine and blood did not react to the Ebola test. It looked as if he had the flu. This was a mystery. Why weren't these guys breaking with Ebola? The weather warmed up and turned sunny, and the wind shifted around until it blew from the south. On the second day of the massive nuking, Wednesday, the Army caravan flowed with commuter traffic to Reston and deployed behind the monkey house. Things went more smoothly. By 8 o'clock in the morning, the teams had begun their insertions. Gene Johnson brought a floodlight, and they set it up in the gray corridor. Jerry Jacks went in first and fed the monkeys. He made his rounds with Sergeant Amon, checking each room, and here and there they found monkeys dead or in terminal shock. In a lounge, they found some chairs and dragged them into a hallway and arranged them in a semicircle so that the soldiers could sit on them while they took their rest breaks and filled up syringes. As the day wore on, You could see exhausted soldiers and civilians in orange spacesuits, men and women, their head bubbles clouded with condensation, sitting on the chairs in the hallway, loading syringes with T-61 and sorting boxes full of blood.